Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoCillaCast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, October 26, 2014, and this is show number 494. We have a giant show today, and I have to get it out before Raleigh leaves on his big overseas vacation, so I got to get going, but I can't possibly start without thanking Bart for stewarding the show last week. I love it when he hosts, and I know you guys do, too. I thought the discussion with George Starcher was awesome. Thank you so much, Bart. Well, as you know, I was at my daughter's wedding, which was absolutely the best time, and it was so nice to know Bart had taken care of everything. At the wedding, she married the man of her dreams in a fabulous setting, and everything went off without a hitch. Everybody got along, everybody's happy, the families are united, it's absolutely wonderful. Nolan, my new son-in-law, issued a challenge to me before the wedding. He asked me whether I could go through the whole wedding without taking photos. I decided to give it a try, and instead of viewing one of the most important days in our life through a tiny viewfinder, I didn't take a single photo. It was an amazing experience, but I'm absolutely dying for the photos from the professional photographer, which won't be here for weeks and weeks and weeks. So, to those of you who said you can't wait to see the photos, sorry to disappoint, but for once, I enjoyed the experience without a camera. All right, enough about all my personal stuff. Let's go ahead and dig into the show. Well, last week on the show, Bart talked about the Poodle vulnerability that was avoidable if you told your browser to remove support for SSL and go to, I think it's TLS1? I think that's what it is. Anyway, I hopped over to podfeet.com to find the link he posted to tell me how to tell Chrome to ignore SSL. The instructions given on the link he gave us were anything but clear. They made me hop between two completely different sites, open a terminal, which, I'm not afraid of the terminal or anything, but I had to run some commands I didn't understand. Those launched Chrome in a safe state, but left the terminal running with all kinds of glop on the screen. I posted about my confusion in the comments on the blog, and Bart explained that even with all that work that I did on Chrome, the fix is only one time. The next time I'd launch Chrome, it would be insecure again. Luckily, Dorothy, also known as Mac Lurker in the chat room, also read my complaints, and she decided to see if she could figure out an easier solution. I scoffed, as I always do, and said it couldn't be done. The next day, she sent me a clarified document giving fantastic instructions on how to solve this problem. It's a very clever solution, actually. Basically, in the tutorial, she teaches you how to create a version of Chrome that applies the terminal command right before launching Chrome. It's just that one line that was in the arcane instructions plopped into an automator action that you save in as an application. I like this because you don't have to trust Dorothy. I do, but you don't have to because you're going to build it yourself and you're going to know exactly what's going on. So it's really, really easy to follow. The arcane instruction, now that I read it in Dorothy's tutorial, simply tells Chrome to launch with a minimum SSL version of TLS1. So if you know what that means from what Bart described, then you're good to go. I love that Dorothy keeps helping us with these automation tasks. If you have something you want her to automate, let me know. If it's not too big of a job, she might just do it for you. I didn't tell her I was going to say that, by the way, but she's not in the live show right now, so... Oh, well. Anyway, of course, there is a link in the show notes to download a PDF of her short tutorial on how to launch Chrome in a safe mode. Hopefully, I'm going to have it up as an actual tutorial later, but we need to get a couple of things lined up before I can get that done. This week, there was a partial solar eclipse around 2 in the afternoon in Los Angeles. I think it was on Thursday, but I'm losing track of time these days. Anyway, Steve suggested a playdate up to the hills in Palos Verdes where we'd have a nice view of the city and the Santa Monica Bay, and he could take video, I could take photos, and we could maybe play with his DJI Phantom quadcopter with his GoPro camera attached. Sound like fun to me. So let me back up a little bit. When Steve and I went on the Mac Mania cruise in Australia, we were planning to see a total eclipse of the sun, and we did get to see it. Steve bought me a very nice solar filter for my DSLR, but too late before the trip, he realized that if he wanted to take video, he too would need a filter for his video camera. On the trip, we had been issued official paper solar sunglasses for viewing the eclipse on the cruise, so he cut one in half, used a stiff paper program guide he found on the ship to make a cylinder, borrowed some duct tape to hold it together from our good friend Wally, and fashioned up a filter cover of his own to fit over his Canon HFS-100 camcorder. Now, luckily, he's great at keeping track of things, as long as that doesn't include his wallet, keys, glasses, iPhone, headphones, that kind of thing. Anyway, so he actually still had this goofy filter when we went looking for it last week. The duct tape when we were on the cruise 2 years ago was already starting to get weird, but by now it was really starting to fall apart, so he dressed up his filter with a fresh coat of black electrical tape, and he was ready to go. In contrast, I have a tendency to procrastinate when it comes to getting rid of things, but I've been making a valiant effort to be better at it. When I got my mirrorless camera, I knew that selling my DSLR quickly was much smarter than waiting, as its value would diminish fairly quickly. Instead of sitting on it, like I usually do, I may have taken a year to sell things and lost, you know, hundreds of dollars by waiting. Instead, I took photos, I sold it through eBay, and I sold all of the lenses using connections I had on Facebook. By the way, hot tip, Facebook is a great way to sell stuff because people know you and trust you. It's like, you know, a garage sale where your neighbors come over. Anyway, we actually sold one of our cars using Facebook. So anyway, I had a lot of peripheral stuff that went with my DSLR. For example, I gave the guy who bought my camera the little camera bag I had for it, and I sold the UV filters with the lenses. When it was all done, I had this one filter left, but I couldn't figure out exactly what it was. It was really, really dark, and it had this kind of goopy mark on it. I had it out on the dining room table where I'd set up my light box for taking fancy photos of my gear for the longest time. I mean, weeks it was sitting on that table. I moved it from downstairs to my desk, and I'd fiddle with it when I was doing other things. I kept looking at this thing, trying to remember what it was. I tried cleaning it to see if I could get the goopy mark off of it, but I couldn't get it off. You know, I still have leftover stuff from my original SLR camera from the 1970s, so I thought maybe it was leftover from that, so finally I just threw it away 2 weeks ago. So here's Steve and I getting ready to go out and view the eclipse, and he says, "Hey, where's your solar filter?" I had completely forgotten that he had bought me this filter, and evidently it was really, really expensive. Worse yet, he had bought an adapter ring so that he could mount it to his camcorder so he wouldn't have to use his goofy little paper glasses contraption. So all we had left was the little adapter ring. Well, sometimes you have to buck up and figure out another way to have fun, so I decided to make one of those pinhole viewers. It's really easy to do. You only need a shoebox, some foil, a box cutter, some tape, and a piece of white paper. I put a link in the show notes to the instructions I followed to make my pinhole viewer out of a simple shoebox. The basic idea is you're projecting the image of the sun onto a piece of paper. Through the pinhole, it actually can project it, and that way you don't feel tempted to stare at the sun and burn out your retinas. I wasn't happy with my pinhole viewer, though, because the image I got was too small. I knew that if I could make a longer box, I'd get a bigger image. So I got two Macy's boxes, you know, the ones you get shirts in. I took the ends apart and I taped them together to make one long box. I tested it out at home, and sure enough, I could see an image of the sun that was a lot bigger than the one in the shoebox. Now, Steve was using my good tripod for his video camera. I think he thinks it's his. Anyway, so I took the tripod that holds my LED light panel for the live video show. It's really short, though. It's only about, I don't know, 3 feet tall. It's a little tiny one, so it sits on my desk. Anyway, the reason this was good, because on the LED light panel, I have an inflatable light box with kind of a plastic egg crate thingy that sort of helps diffuse the light. I realized that I could strap this long, goofy box down to that flat surface. I made a couple of holders out of strapping tape, and I got a leather piece to tie around the box so I knew I could at least keep it from sliding down or blowing away if there was some wind. I'm telling you, me and Steve, we're like MacGyver around here. All right, off we went to Palos Verdes to have some fun. Steve got his camcorder set up with a wide-angle view so he'd be sure to capture the sun moving across the sky and the moon occluding it as it moved across. He really wanted to get close-up footage of the eclipse, though. So next, he tried zooming in. He put the sun off to one edge and recorded until it got to the other edge. Then he repositioned the tripod and repeated this procedure. When he was done, he had a set of three separate recordings that, if stitched together properly, would show off the progression of the eclipse. I really thought it was cool how he achieved this. When he got home, he imported the videos into Final Cut Pro 10, and he got to work. He shrunk each video down by 50%, and then he was able to align the sun's position at the beginning of one clip to the end of the previous clip. Now, you can imagine you've got these three rectangles with the images on it, and you got a lot of empty space around in the full frame. So what he did was he took a sample of the sky, because it wasn't pure black. It's really dark through these filters, but it wasn't pure black. It had some grain in it. So he took a sample of the sky, and he spread it across the entire frame as a background. Finally, he sped it up 60:1, so it is a lovely 28-second video. I've embedded the video in the show notes so you can see his masterpiece. It's pretty cool. All right, now back to the viewing of the clips. Once he had his camcorder running, he didn't really have too much to do. He watched me trying to enjoy this teeny tiny little view of the eclipse inside my pinhole viewer box. It was pretty cool, actually. With his vision, anyway, you could see the eclipse and even see a sunspot on the little image. My eyes aren't that good, but I could see the eclipse. In this day and age, an experience doesn't count, though, if you don't have photographic evidence, right? I was trying to take pictures of this little tiny image, and I was not having a lot of success. Steve then got another marvelous idea. He still had one more pair of those paper solar sunglasses from the cruise. He took the lens ring, remember the one that was supposed to hold the filter? And he taped it to one of the lenses on the glasses. He then covered all of the air gap with black electrical tape. In this way, I could hold the lens ring with the glasses attached over the end of my camera by hand, and I could safely take pictures of the sun. Now, I'm doing this all handheld, right? Because I don't have a tripod I can mount it on. Anyway, you're not going to believe this, but it worked really well. I got the best images around 1/80th of a second exposure, set the white balance to sunlight. I figured that one out all by myself. By the way, I did try some other ones because it does come out kind of yellow, but I guess the sun is yellow. Anyway, I zoomed in to an effective 300 millimeters. I put a small version of one of the photos in the show notes, but if you click on it, you can see it in pretty high res. The coolest part was the sunspot was insane. It really fired up that day, and Steve sent me a message later that the sunspot had exploded into some massive solar flares shortly after the eclipse. Anyway, I guess this is a story of me being a moron throwing away a filter, Steve being MacGyver, and in the end, both of us being able to get some pretty cool imagery of a partial solar eclipse. Like so many others, I had to go out right away and try Apple Pay on the iPhone 6 on day one. I knew I'd have to put my credit cards in first, so I opened up the languishing Passbook app and tried to scan in my credit card. The little box kept bouncing in and out, but never recognized the card. It's when I realized I probably had to upgrade to iOS 8.1, right? Duh. Anyway, after the upgrade to iOS 8.1, I immediately saw the change in Passbook. You get a new option on top to add a credit card rather than another kind of card. Unfortunately, they sucked all the fun out of adding the card by offering to let me use the card I already had on file with Apple. Of course, that's the one I wanted to use. Well, I decided to try my backup credit card. Now, I have to have a backup card because Citibank is always claiming that I have unusual spending and blocking my card. They do it all the time. They drive me nuts. They stopped my card once when I bought something at Apple. Oh, that looked like unusual activity. I, of course, explained that if they see a month I don't spend some money with Apple, my card's stolen. Anyway, I tried my second Citibank MasterCard. The first one's a Visa. MasterCard didn't work. I got a pop-up suggesting I call the bank, so I guess I'll just harass them for the fun of that. So now it's time to go on the hunt for somewhere to spend my money via Apple Pay. As luck would have it, my son Kyle and I were driving around on Tuesday, so I convinced him to stop by Walgreens because they take Apple Pay. Unfortunately, he thought I meant CVS, who, by the way, have blocked Apple Pay. They're dead to me. So he missed the turn to Walgreens, and he was hungry, and he wouldn't go back to Walgreens. I should have made him go to McDonald's for dinner because they take Apple Pay, but he wanted El Pollo Loco, and they don't. So I missed doing it on day one. He said, quit your whining. You'll be going to Starbucks in the morning anyway, and I'm sure you can use it there. But the next morning when we went to Starbucks, they said they weren't ready to take Apple Pay yet. Foiled again. Okay, fine. I went to the Apple store to buy a Mac Mini. I figured they'd let me use Apple Pay, right? Well, maybe they would have, but they didn't have the model Mac Mini I wanted, so I had to leave without buying anything. Okay, well then I thought, I'll stop by Petco, because it's right near the Apple store, because they take Apple Pay. Except then I realized the one nearby was a PetSmart, not a Petco. Foiled again. Then I remembered that Steve needed printer cartridges, and I was right next to an Office Depot. I grabbed the cartridges, went to the checkout counter, and proudly announced I would be paying with Apple Pay. The guy said, so what's that? I explained it to him, and he said, oh, yeah, I saw that on TV. So much for training at Office Depot. Anyway, he rang me up and then pointed at the credit card scanner where there was a logo that looked like a tap-to-pay kind of thing. I held the iPhone near it, and suddenly there was a Touch ID fingerprint dead center on my screen. In my excitement, I put my finger on that icon in the middle of the screen, like a moron. Anyway, before anybody could notice what a dummy I was, I moved my thumb down to the real Touch ID, and the on-screen symbol showed my fingerprint filling in, and just like a split second, put up a nice check mark showing transaction complete. I was all excited, and then the guy behind the counter said, I don't think it went through. That was weird because it had something on screen like last transaction just now here in this city. I couldn't find any evidence on his end, though, so he went and got his manager. At least she'd been to training and had actually heard about it, but she couldn't figure out how to do it either. She ran off to get a third guy. This guy seemed to actually know what he was doing. He explained to the first guy that he had to bring up the credit screen first. He then had me use Touch ID again, and this time we saw the credit card number field fly under the screen as dots and then disappear almost instantly. That time I got a confirmation saying exactly what the transaction was and how much money I'd paid, so we knew it was real. There was a little comedy still to be had, though. The guy said, "You still have to sign the little scanner device," which is kind of stupid. Later, I actually happened to need to go to a different Office Depot a second time that week, and that time there was zero confusion at all, and they didn't make me sign at the end. The only reason I had a problem was that I tried to get a screenshot of the thumbprint on screen so I could have it in the show notes so you could see where I was pushing stupidly, but that was really hard because you have to use the home button to take the screenshot, right? I was able to capture it, but it wasn't easy. Bottom line is that Touch ID worked great with Apple Pay, and it actually made my life easier the second time I went to Office Depot. I walk there. When I walk, I have my phone anyway to listen to podcasts, so this time I didn't have to bring a credit card along or my license. Very cool stuff. It'll be way cooler when it's everywhere, of course, and when CVS supports it because I go there all the time. Andy sent in a link to a really interesting article over on Medium.com about exactly how easy it is to be hacked if you're using open Wi-Fi networks. Mauritius Martin takes a trip to a random cafe in Amsterdam with a gentleman named Wouter Slotbaum, who uses a small black device to spoof the Wi-Fi network in the cafe. Now, Bart has been warning us for years about this, but reading exactly how easy this was for the guy to do it is pretty chilling. One of the things that makes it so easy is that our devices will automatically connect to a network for which we've already connected in the past. So imagine you've been to a Starbucks, say, and you've connected to the Wi-Fi network called Google Starbucks. His device can tell you've been attached to that network in the past. All he has to do is create a hotspot called Google Starbucks, and your device will auto-connect to that network. Once your device connects to his network, he has access to all of the traffic you send, usernames, passwords, everything you're pretty much owned. This got me to thinking. I've mentioned before that for the teeny tiny fee of $3 a month, I have all of Steve and my devices, our Macs, our iPhones, iPads, all of them protected by the VPN service from Cloak. I wrote to the folks at Cloak asking whether I was protected, since those same fake names could be used to trick me. Luckily, they had seen the article. At first, I kind of had my brain backwards on this. I asked whether if I told Cloak to trust Starbucks Google, would the hackers be able to get to me? Dave from Cloak said they would be able to get to me. I realized in my second message, though, my absolute mistake. The most important thing in Cloak is that you don't tell it to trust any open Wi-Fi networks like Google Starbucks, which means it will always be securing you when you're on that network. Now, I wanted to make sure that I understood, so I wrote one more thing to him. I wrote, "One of my favorite things is walking into Starbucks and seeing that nice VPN logo jump up as soon as I connect to that untrusted network. Now, my understanding is that if Google is Starbucks has configured everything in a reasonable way, I am protected by Cloak, right? Someone spoofing the Starbucks Google Wi-Fi name would not grab my connection before Cloak can save me?" To which Dave from Cloak replied, "That's correct. Even if you connected to a spoof Starbucks network, let's call it evil Starbucks, Cloak for Macs overcloak feature will prevent you from leaking information until after it is successfully secured to your connection. And if Cloak for Mac can't secure your connection on evil Starbucks, it simply won't let you access the internet at all. It's annoying as heck, but preferable to the alternative." In a follow-on conversation, Dave also pointed out that it's important to make sure you rename your home network to something unique. For example, if you have a Linksys router at home and don't rename it, but you tell Cloak to trust that router, then when you waltz into Starbucks, you know the hacker's going to have one of his or her fake networks called Linksys, and you're going to get owned. Now, I'm really glad Andy sent this article over because it made me really think and understand how important it is to have the VPN service like Cloak to protect us on insecure Wi-Fi networks. Now, Cloak is not the only one out there, but I understand it even better than I did before, and I'll only trust networks that I actually know. And if you want to be protected for a measly $3 a month, check out Cloak at getcloak.com. By the way, if you use up the 5 gigabytes a month you get for that $3 a month, you can upgrade mid-month to an unlimited plan for only $10 a month, and they prorate your plan. And at the end of the month, at the end of your billing cycle, you can just bump it back down to $3. So it's really inexpensive, and it will keep you safe on all of your iOS and Mac devices. When we were talking about Dorothy's instructions on how to make your Chrome browser safe, I blithely referred to the fact that she made a clarified tutorial to do this. Now, I'm usually the one making these tutorials, so it was awesome to be the recipient of one. Because she used Clarify, she was able to put in giant arrows and circles, telling me where to click, what things to look at. She threw in some text to explain what to do, and then she put in a text box for the code that I had to copy and paste into Automator. At the end of it, she hit Export to PDF. When I got her instructions, I had zero problems understanding what to do. Unlike those arcane instructions I had mentioned before, trying to follow those, I had no confusion when I was looking at her instructions. It was as though she had clarified it for me. Now, I actually mean no puns intended there. That's why they named it that. Anyway, if you want to be as brilliant as Dorothy, all you have to do is first go to college for 4 years, get a degree in programming, and become a software engineer for 35 years, then buy a copy of Clarify to teach people what you know over at clarify-it.com. Well, it's that time of the week again. It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pod with Bart Bouchatz. Thank you so much for hosting the show last week. It was amazing.
Oh, thanks. It was fun to do. I sort of look at doing your show as like, you know, kids. They're fun to play with other people's kids, but I'm glad I get to give it back. It's a lot of work to do your show.
Oh, well, I hope you didn't mind me sneaking in a couple of times.
No, well, that's less work for me, so.
Exactly. It was a great show, and I love the discussion with George Starcher. He's got such a fabulous voice and so much knowledge, and the discussion was fantastic. It was really, really interesting.
You know, it was great talking to George. Myself and George stayed on Skype, like, for hours afterwards, catching up. Just
yeah, we
too
need
long
to get him.
We chatted.
We need to dust him off more often.
Exactly.
All right, well, we should probably kick into this week's show.
Sure. So starting with Security Lite and with updates that have been released, Apple have released iOS 8.1, which fixes Poodle.
Oh, good.
It's confusingly fixing Poodle because Apple have done sort of a precision strike on Poodle instead of doing what everyone is recommending, which is just turning off SSL3.
Mm-hmm.
So the actual Poodle bug requires SSL3 in combination with a subset of cryptographic ciphers. And Apple have turned off the mix of the two, but not turned off SSL3 completely. And most of the testing websites are testing for just, is SSL3 present? And therefore, you're getting these very mixed results, but it's fine.
Okay.
What is fine. Similar story, 10.10 Yosemite patches Poodle and Shellshock. Same kettle of fish there.
Okay.
And then for people on 10.8 and 10.9, there is Security Update 2014-005, which patches Poodle and Shellshock.
Now, here's what bothers me. When I just switched to Yosemite because it's more fun to change it right before recording a show.
I recorded your show on a Friday, and I did it on a Friday so I could play with Yosemite on the Saturday.
I wanted to make sure it was as dangerous as possible, so I waited. But when I was on Mavericks, I did Security Update 2014-005, and I went to the site you suggested the test to see if mm-hmm. you're patched, and it said nope.
Yep, for all the same reasons. Again, Apple have chosen to do a sort of a precision strike instead of a full-blown just kill SSL3. Now, they've sent out a thing to developers saying that they have to change some of the stuff in apps, and then they're going to turn off SSL3 completely. So I think this is actually a stopgap.
Okay, so if even though it says I wasn't patched, I really was?
Yes.
Okay.
Confusing, okay. Right? Just very confusing. Bottom line, if you're using Safari on iOS or OS 10 and you're fully patched, then you are fine for
Poodle. Golden. Okay, fantastic. Now, by now, people will have heard me talking about Dorothy's Chrome Safe that allows you to more efficiently and easily keep Chrome safe until they get that fixed.
Yes, and that was really cool, actually. I like that Dorothy did that.
She's amazing.
Yeah.
She's all mad, though. I thought I had another bug for her to fix in a script I had, and I was mistaken, and she was sad.
Oh, no.
So if you need anything automated.
Ooh, I don't know. I don't like fixing other people's bugs.
No. I mean, Dorothy will go off. Dorothy will go off and automate anything you want. She's sad when she has nothing to automate.
Cool.
All right. So,
okay. So that's Apple.
Okay.
Then it was Patch Tuesday, so Adobe did Flash and Air, Microsoft did Office, including the Mac version, IE and .NET, and Oracle did Java. So all of those new
everything things. Else.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
Okay.
Although, actually, none of the PDF stuff, so just Flash and Air from Adobe.
Yeah, so a late month.
Yes. So moving into news, Microsoft are warning about a zero-day attack that uses your favorite file format in the world, PowerPoint.
Oh, PowerPoint is evil. It should die.
Yeah, the bug isn't in PowerPoint as such, but the bug is triggered by sending a malicious PowerPoint file.
So oh, okay. So
it is one of those trust the Microsoft fix-it thingies where you can go in and they sort of do a workaround that will keep you safe until they genuinely patch it. So the links are in the show notes.
So it's not a vulnerability in PowerPoint?
No, it's a vulnerability in a part
in
of the
Windows
OS,
or
which can be
which OS?
Windows.
Okay, so that is specifically a Windows update.
Yes, sorry,
Windows
that is, yes.
Okay. Okay.
Then the website Whisper may not whisper nearly as much as they sort of like to make you think it does.
Wait, what is Whisper? Never heard of it.
It's supposed to be one of these things where you can anonymously post online. Only it turns out that it's not so much anonymous, and we find this out because they tried to sell services to the Guardian newspaper in the UK where they demoed to the Guardian how they could follow important people and get news.
Oh my gosh! So, would this be equivalent to like using the Tor network? Is it that sort of thing?
Well, no. It's supposed to be a social network that's anonymous. That's its problem.
Oh, it's a social network. Oh, okay. Oh, that's horrible.
It is horrible. And so, what they ended up doing is, so the Guardian were given this demo, and the Guardian went, "Holy moly, this is just not on." So they turned that demo into a news story.
They figured that's a better story, huh?
Right. It's wow. Yeah. It's not good.
Well, good on them.
Then, in a very, very similar vein, a hack of a third-party website leaked 13 gigabytes of Snapchat images.
So, yeah. Oh, I heard about this one, but it wasn't a hack of Snapchat? How did this happen?
See, it wasn't a hack of Snapchat in the strictest of senses. So the theory of Snapchat is that your photos are ephemeral. They show up for, I think it's 5 seconds. I've never used the app because the one thing that has been in common every time we've mentioned Snapchat in Security Light is that the photos have not actually been ephemeral because the Android app was marking them as deleted but leaving them on the file system. It's just problem after problem. And there are third parties. There's a third-party website which you log into. You give that third-party website your Snapchat credentials. It then connects to Snapchat pretending to be a client, asks for all your pictures, and then doesn't delete them and lets you archive them and keep them.
Okay.
So that website has this giant collection of supposedly ephemeral images, and that website then got hacked. Right, look, the bottom line is they're not ephemeral. It doesn't matter what Snapchat promise in their marketing bump, it's not ephemeral. I don't think
yeah.
it's such.
It doesn't sound like it.
Yeah, so I mean,
it's still fun. You know, in a 13-year-old girl kind of way.
You've hit on probably the worst thing about all of this is that there are people of that age group doing things they really shouldn't be doing using Snapchat because they think it's safe.
Yeah.
Many shades of ick.
I don't know that most people even think about safe.
Yeah.
I don't know. Well, anyway.
Snapchat is not, be wary of the Snapchatting. Then there was an interesting report that the Chinese government were trying to do man-in-the-middle attacks against iCloud, to which Apple responded actually with a really nice sort of knowledge base article outlining the things you should look for if someone's trying to intercept your iCloud, which is basically a certificate warning. And if you get a certificate warning, you should not continue.
So how I didn't understand this one. I feel like okay. I came in the middle of the plot because I was out of town. But what is happening? Who's doing what and okay. how are they doing it?
Assuming we believe the website which reports on what the Chinese government are up to, and I have no reason to disbelieve that, but that's who I'm believing. Mm-hmm. So the Chinese government control pretty much all of the internet in China. So they have the power to be a man in the middle.
Sure.
So they can simply create a fake certificate for iCloud.com, redirect the DNS to their server instead of to Apple's server, and if that will generate a warning, because that's not the real certificate. But if the
but don't they have a certificate authority of their own they control that they could make fake it?
They may well do, but Apple may be doing stuff to make sure that
make sure it's not that one.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Because Apple control Safari and Apple control iCloud, they can do clever things. In the same way okay. actually, that Gmail and Chrome and Gmail are a very safe combination with each other because Google do something called certificate pinning, which means that even if a valid-looking certificate that's been issued by a real certificate authority is not Google's certificate, Chrome will say, eh-eh.
Oh, okay.
So Apple may be doing something equally clever. They don't say, so that's only a guess.
But so this doesn't have to be the Chinese government doing it. It's just an easy possibility.
Where it was and how it was done makes people think it was. But there's no, you can't prove that. Could you possibly prove that?
And anyway, Apple's not going to point at it, right?
Yeah. Someone was at it, and Apple issued quite a nice page, actually, with nice screenshots and everything. And to be honest, even if you're not in China and you're wondering, what would it look like if someone was trying to man in the middle me? I would say, look at this, and then you'll know what it looks like.
Okay.
Because it could happen to you in an internet cafe, right? Someone else, right. Someone at Starbucks could do it to you. It doesn't have to be the Chinese government.
Right.
So, you know, I thought it was a nice website, so I thought we'd link to it. Apple also published a security guide for how iOS security hangs together, including how Apple Pay works.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Is it human readable?
I'd be honest, I haven't got around to trying to read it. These things are usually a little bit on the dense side.
Right, right.
The thing is, all of the people who I trust to read this kind of thing are reading it, and they're not waving their arms about in panic, and that's a good thing.
Okay. Because New York Linda and I have been going back and forth trying to understand how it's working, and we keep finding articles that are way too hard to follow.
Well, I know you don't generally go with the Security Now thing because you don't generally think it's pitched quite right for you, but I would say listen to the one on Apple Pay.
Oh, okay.
Because I think it is human-friendly.
Oh, good, good.
The short version
I actually do like the show, but for some reason Steve Gibson's voice kind of puts me to sleep. On video, not so much, but listening on audio, I just kind of go into a trance. It's good for running, so I just go into this weird zone where I'm not conscious anymore.
Well, it works.
But I really like him.
Well, that's good. No, it's basically the credit card industry laid out a general architecture for how one should do this kind of thing, and Apple took that plan and made it real.
Okay.
And it hangs together well, is the bottom line. It is a sound design. And then the last thing I thought I should mention is the Washington Post generated a giant big kerfuffle by discovering, in air quotes, that Yosemite Spotlight does exactly what Apple said Yosemite Spotlight would do. This is one of those scandals where there is nothing, there's no there. So when you open up Yosemite first and you click on the little magnifying glass or you hit Command Space to bring up the Spotlight image, it will tell you about 10 pixels away from where the flashy cursor is that in this new version of Safari, it now searches the web as well. And then it says, if you want to change that, here's a button. And it tells you instructions how to change it. So people are saying, Apple, sending your keystrokes behind your back. And I'm going, if this is behind my back, what's in my face?
So I'm looking at it right now. It says, In addition to searching your Mac, Spotlight now shows suggestions from the internet, iTunes, App Store, movie showtimes, locations nearby, and more. To make suggestions more relevant to you, Spotlight includes your approximate location and search request to Apple. You can change this in preferences. Learn more.
Right. To me, that's very much the opposite of behind your back.
Yeah.
Apple went on when this kerfuffle started to actually give a more detailed statement. And actually, even before the kerfuffle started, there was already a detailed paragraph about how it all works on their privacy page. The bottom line is, your computer takes your search, it takes your location, but rounds it off. So it doesn't give you your exact location, it sort of chops a few decimal places off it to make it a sort of fuzzy area.
Mm-hmm.
It then uses a randomly generated identifier that only lasts for 15 minutes, and then it sends your search off to Apple with that. So Apple can't track you because it's not your Apple ID that's being sent, it's this random identifier, and the random identifier changes every 15 minutes, so it's impossible to have a long-term profiling of people because the identity keeps changing every 15 minutes.
They couldn't reverse engineer what your identity was at that point in time?
Well, no, because all this is happening on your computer before you send it, so what's being sent to Apple doesn't contain your Apple ID, it contains this ephemeral ID.
Oh, how interesting.
So it's actually a very clever design. So
the sky is falling, Bart.
I know. If I wanted to design a system to do this cloudy-like functionality in the safest possible way, I'd design it like this.
Hmm.
There's lots on this, but the sky is not falling. It's fine.
And you have a link to a mini rant on
I got people so fed up with the discussion that I just sort of took the screenshot, put some arrows in, and I went,
Really?
Really, yeah. Pretty much. Notable breaches. We have two, Kmart and Staples. I believe they're both large corporations in your country.
Yeah.
The quicker Apple Pay comes into full use, the better.
This just in, Steve just tweeted that Rite Aid and CVS just moved to disable Apple Pay support in their stores. It was unofficially working because they're going to participate in Merchant Customer Exchange, a retailer group developing its own mobile payment system.
Oh, God. It's not supposed to be. You don't pick one and pick a fight. You're supposed to support as many.
Turn them all on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway. Right. Sorry. Suggested reading. I mentioned in passing, you could be in public Wi-Fi and something dangerous could happen. If you ever want to actually see what I mean when I say that, and I say that quite often, there's a website, I believe they're in the Netherlands this was done, where they took a hacker and they went to an internet cafe and let him at it for 20 minutes and saw what he could do.
Ooh.
And basically, it's a lot. Your VPN is very valuable to you when you're in an internet cafe, is the takeaway from this. As I say, a link in the show notes, you can read all the details there.
And actually, I think by this time I will have had a conversation on the show about it, because a listener sent that in, and I talked to, I've got some text from Cloak explaining how you're not vulnerable if you're using Cloak, you know, or another VPN service.
Excellent. Oh, that's cool. Yes. It's a really good article, actually, to sort of bring it home to people.
Yeah.
The saga of US law enforcement versus U.S. citizen security continues. Apple have turned on full disk encryption by default on Yosemite. The head of the FBI is asking to let them spy on people. And Wired have actually a very strong rebuttal against the head of the FBI's speech. So if you're interested, there's the pros, the cons. Make up your own mind.
That was the third thing you hadn't answered me before the show. I was telling Bart we hadn't talked. Yeah, I sent you a link to the 60 Minutes interview with the FBI director. Yes, that I thought was really, really interesting.
I would recommend having a read of the Wired rebuttal for the other point of view on Mr. Comey's point of view.
And you and I can chat offline about what you thought about it, but that, I knew there was a third thing that I'd asked you about. Back up a little bit, though. So I just installed Yosemite. I have full disk encryption on now?
Did you install it from scratch or did you install it over?
Upgrade.
I'm not. Okay. I was upgrading from encrypted to encrypted, so it didn't ask me anything. I don't know what it does if you upgrade from
It couldn't have. It would have had to have asked me to give it a key and all, like, or to copy down my key.
Well, it just would have actually had to ask you. Well, now it can let you do it through your iCloud. So you can use your iCloud login.
Right. There would have been a conversation.
There would have been a conversation, yes. If you install Yosemite from scratch, a fresh install, you have that conversation with the installer. As in, a screen pops up saying, we'd like to turn it on. The checkboxes are all checked by default. You uncheck them if you want not to encrypt.
It must not have been true with the Gold Master, because I didn't get that on my external drive either, where I did it from scratch on one of those. But I upgraded through a couple of revs there. But I just checked, and FileVault is not on yet.
Okay.
It's on my to-do list.
It's easy. It's very pleasantly easy.
Don McAllister just did a screencast on it and showed how it's done. He managed to make it sound a little more complicated, but it was pretty easy.
No, I do it now without thinking. I like how good it is. Anyway, Facebook are here for two good reasons. So first off, Facebook are proactively going around checking all of the leaked passwords from all of the kabillion breaches and checking to see if any of them are reused on Facebook. And if they are, they're making people change their passwords.
Wait, there's good Facebook security news?
Yeah, and that's one of the two good stories.
Okay.
So that's great that they're proactively finding people with duplicate passwords and protecting them before they have a chance to be hacked. Thumbs up.
In case anybody's wondering, they can't actually necessarily see the passwords, but they can check and see if the hash is the same.
Exactly.
Look how smart I am after listening to you for 5 years.
And the other thing Facebook have done is they've kind of publicly chastised the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration for using Facebook to impersonate people in an attempt to trap drug dealers, which... I'm pretty sure I know the word for that. I believe it's entrapment.
Don't they do, like, honeypots? That's a common thing.
Yeah, well, in this case, they arrested someone and then became her on Facebook.
Oh, right. I do remember that one, yeah.
And Facebook basically went, this is completely against our
policy. So they weren't a fake person, honeypot. They were a real person.
Yes, they were fraudulently a real person, yes. So at Facebook, I made quite a public stand about it, which is actually in everyone's interest. So
yeah, there's another legal term for that, too, when you impersonate somebody. But anyway, okay.
Yes. And then finally, I'm afraid it's not really good news finally, but the Snowden revelations continue, and apparently the NSA have sort of infiltrated private industry in an attempt to sabotage security from the inside. Yay!
You know, I can't even hear it anymore. You just said those words, and I'm reading them, and I heard blah, 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 NSA, bad, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, that's why I put it at the end of suggested reading. I'm pretty sure 90% of people have fatigue on this, but in case anyone doesn't, yeah. I figure we should still link them.
Definitely. Why should I just looked at how much we got to do in taming the terminal here. I better let you get started, huh?
Yeah. Now this, I've done 22 of these so far. This is the 23rd, and they usually take me about 4 hours to write. There is about 12 hours to get it to the stage it's at now.
Oh, geez. Because, this isn't a 2-hour session, is it?
No. Most of that 12 hours, it took me, you know, an hour or two to get it all written down, and it was huge. The rest of the time has been refining it to get it to exactly as little as it can be, but no less than it needs to be.
Okay.
And right, we have a bit of a starter's dilemma here, because to understand the big picture of networking, you have to understand the detail. And to understand the detail, you have to understand the big picture.
So you start in the middle and just squirt out either end?
So what I'm going to do is I'm going to start with the big picture, with the caveat that it's probably not going to make perfect sense, but hopefully the gist of it will sink in. And then we're going to go through the detail, constantly referring back to the big picture. And hopefully that will sort of bulk it out to the point that when we're finished, it'll all make sense.
So you can do the broad brush strokes, and then when you fill in the details, it'll make more sense.
Yes. So, and I think I've been thinking about it a lot. I've been thinking about this actually for 2 weeks and how best to start this topic. And I've decided that the way my lecturer taught me back in Maynooth University is probably the right way. And this is how he did it. And it sunk in for me, so I'm hoping.
Good. Good. I don't quite understand what networking has to do with the terminal, but I suspect that by the end of this I will.
Well, networking has the same to do with the terminal as file systems do. It is something with which there are many terminal commands to interact with.
Okay.
And our home computer experience is very networked. How much you do that's totally local these days?
Not much.
Right? So that means that
the podcast, but
the network is about as important to us as our hard drives these days. So therefore, understanding how it, you know, debugging network problems is something we all unfortunately have to do, and the terminal can be a superb help at demystifying what on earth is going on in that little grey cable. And so that, that's the point of this. Or even worse, in those airwaves you can't even see. So let us kick into this with that caveat in mind. So, you know, expect to be confused. It's okay.
Okay.
And the good news is that if we'd been doing this 20 years ago, you'd be even more confused. Right? We have the luxury that we as a planet have decided on one network stack. We have decided that the TCP/IP networking stack is the networking stack we will use. And that wasn't true when I was at university. Apple was using their own entirely separate system called AppleTalk. Digital Electronics Corporation.
Yeah.
Digital Electronics Corporation had something called DECnet. Microsoft were using a combination of NetBIOS and its sort of shinier friend NetBUI. And you had all of these competing protocols all trying to mush through the same wires. It was a mess. And trying to understand how the network worked meant understanding all of those complications. Well, thank goodness we live in a world where TCP/IP won. And the only thing we have to worry about is how TCP/IP works. Still kind of complicated, but it's all TCP/IP, so that is the king. And TCP/IP has actually been around for a staggeringly long time. It used to have a different name. It used to be called ARPANET.
I remember that. That was from DARPA?
Well, see, back then it was called ARPA. It didn't get the D until later.
Okay.
And ARPANET went live in 1969.
Wow.
Now, that long heritage is very much a mixed blessing. So on the one hand, the rough edges have been knocked off this stuff. The bugs have been beaten out to a very, 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 very high degree, which is good. You know, long life is good for shaking out problems. The problem is, when they were designing it, no one really thought it would take off to anything near the extent it did take off. I mean, I don't think any of the designers imagined that we would have a phone, a tablet, a laptop, and a desktop computer that all be on the network together. And billions of devices around the planet. I don't think anyone conceived of that, or that we would do commerce on this stuff. And therefore, no one really thought about security. It was all about making it go, because the problem was so big, getting it to work at all was a miracle. And security is an afterthought, which means we have retrofitted it, and we've spent decades trying to bolt it on. But bolted on security is never quite as good as security you built in from the start. And so the price we pay for this very stable, you know, well-established protocol is that the security aspect's a little bit shaky. And we kind of know that from how many years now of Security Lite?
We had a little bit of that, yeah.
We had a little bit of that.
I think so, that's come up.
Yeah. So, that, you know, that's the pros and the cons. So big picture-wise, there's a few principles we need to beat in. So the real genius they had at ARPA was basically before they had this brainwave, everyone thought of computer networks like a telephone system, that when two computers wanted to talk to each other, you should have some sort of exchange, and they should be then connected directly together like two people on a telephone. And that would be really
like
difficult.
A direct point-to-point connection.
Yeah, that would be really difficult. And the guys in ARPA went, no. You take the data you want to send, you smash it into teeny tiny little pieces, and you send each piece one by one, and let each piece fight for itself, and it'll make its way to the other end, and then you can put it back together when you're finished.
Okay.
Right? And the name they come up with that is called a packet-switched network. So that's the jargon for how TCP works. But basically, you don't try to send a file. You try to send a small piece of data. And if you can solve that problem, then the next problem is breaking it apart and putting it together. And so by breaking big data into little pieces, they made it possible to do this at all. And so the network works in packets. They are like the atom of the internet, is the packet. The other thing to say is that TCP/IP is a best effort protocol. Right?
What?
It sounds as bad as it is. A router is entirely free to throw away a packet. If a router is too busy, 10 packets come in, it only has room for 8. 2 of them go away. It gets to decide. Perfectly acceptable within the protocol. So it's best
really?
Effort. We'll try to deliver your data, but it may not get there.
So that's okay if you've got, like, video.
Ah, but we see.
But if I'm sending...
So hopefully the magic of it will become clear in a minute. But yes, you're right. The entire internet, every packet that exists on the internet can be thrown away at any time, and that is true. And despite the fact that that's true, I can send you a file and know you get it perfectly.
Okay.
That's the magic of it, right? That is right. IP packets can vanish into the ether, if you'll excuse the terrible pun. And despite that fact, we have managed to make it possible to reliably send information.
It's magic.
It is kind of magic. The other thing to say is that TCP/IP is a strictly layered stack of protocols. And the layering is very strict. So it's one builds on the other, builds on the other, builds on the other. And the only communication between the protocols is to adjacent protocols. You can't skip. So Ethernet talks to IP, IP talks to TCP, TCP talks to TLS, TLS talks to HTTP. And you can go the other way, HTTP to TLS to TCP, da-da-da-da-da. You can never skip. HTTP can never talk to Ethernet.
Okay, that's what they mean by layered?
Yes, you always talk to the person you're adjacent to in the stack. Always.
Okay.
Now, there's more than 4 protocols in the stack, but it is very, very useful to think of that whole stack of protocols as being 4 groups of protocols. And we call those groups the network abstraction layers. And abstraction is the key word, right? This is a really, really useful abstraction, but it is an abstraction. And so we've broken the problem into 4 groups. We have the link layer set of problems to be solved. We have the internet layer set of problems to be solved, the transport layer set of problems to be solved, and the application layer set of problems to be solved. And that kind of is how it works.
If we're to the part where I'm supposed to be confused, then good. I'm keeping up.
Okay, at the moment, these are just some vague facts I've thrown out, right?
Good. Okay.
So let's dig in a little deeper. And we're going to start our digging in.
Like, what does abstraction mean?
It means it's a... It's a way of thinking about it rather than a physical thing.
Okay.
So when we describe a hard disk as being a bunch of files, that's an abstraction because it's actually a bunch of little magnetic things with ones or zeros. So anyway, so we think about the network as being these four layers that are stacked on top of each other, and information moves between those layers, but they can never skip a layer, just like you can't skip a protocol.
Okay.
So at the very, 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 very bottom of the pile, the most fundamental problem to be solved is getting some ones and zeros from one computer to another computer that's physically connected in some way. And
okay.
That's where we start. That is the bottom layer, and that is called the link layer.
So just, are we talking to each other?
Yeah. And in fact, the link layer just promises to try to deliver a single packet between two computers on the same network. That is the problem it solves, and it does nothing more. And the whole point of these layers is that each of them solves a problem and nothing more. And so the layers above can assume the problem below is solved. And they don't care how, they just know it has been solved. And that frees those layers up not to care. And because this is such a giant problem, this ability to segment the problem so that every layer is looking after its own part of the problem makes it possible. It just wouldn't be possible otherwise. So within our houses, within our home networks, there is one protocol that sits down there in that link layer that is absolute king of the roost, and that protocol is Ethernet.
So Ethernet is an abstraction layer above?
Ethernet is a protocol inside layer one.
Oh, inside the link layer.
Yes.
Okay.
It's not the only thing in the link layer, but it is in the link layer, and it is what makes our networks go within our houses. And Ethernet is actually an abstraction in itself, because there isn't one Ethernet, right? So the Ethernet protocol can operate over pieces of copper twisted together, put inside some shielding, and put with the, I think it's an RJ45 jack on the end. And everyone calls that an Ethernet cable. It's actually a patch cable, because Ethernet doesn't only go over cables. Ethernet flies through the air, too. Wi-Fi is Ethernet.
What?
Wi-Fi and copper are both implementations of the Ethernet protocol.
Oh, so that's why you say it's a patch cable that carries Ethernet or a Wi-Fi router that carries Ethernet?
Exactly, because that same patch cable could carry a phone signal.
I hate knowing stuff like that. That's the kind of thing that makes me go, well, actually, you know,
it is.
You turn into that annoying nerd ball.
If it makes you feel any better, I still call them Ethernet cables at work. Although, actually, no, we call them Cat5 or Cat6, but it doesn't matter. So the whole point is that the link layer is worrying about just getting one packet, one itty-bitty packet from one computer, from one device to another device that's connected to it either in some sort of way, be that through radio waves, through electrical signals in copper, through a fiber optic cable with light shooting up and down it. It's just worrying about getting one piece of information through one connection. That's all it's worrying about. And there's loads to worry about in that, and we'll hear more about that as we go through the series, but that's actually quite a difficult problem.
Okay.
So within our houses, Ethernet does that magic for us. And Ethernet, by the way, in case you're curious, Ethernet talks to MAC addresses. So at the Ethernet level, your computer has a MAC address, and your other computer has a MAC address. And as far as Ethernet is concerned, that's the only identifier in the world that exists. Ethernet talks MAC address to MAC address. The rest doesn't exist as far as little old Ethernet is concerned. Now,
and MAC address is that hardwired code that every network adapter has. So our phones have those. Our microwaves probably have them by now, but everything has one, right?
Everything that can talk Ethernet, i.e. everything that can talk Wi-Fi or everything that you can shove an Ethernet cable into has a MAC address. And they're different. So your computer has a different MAC, has two MAC addresses. If it has an Ethernet jack and a Wi-Fi card, the Wi-Fi card will have one MAC address, the Ethernet jack will have another MAC address. And Ethernet just sends one packet of information from one MAC address to another MAC address. That's all it knows how to do. Our home routers actually also can talk Ethernet, because otherwise we couldn't talk to the internet. But our home routers can talk more layer one protocols. ISDN is a layer one protocol. It gets one piece of information from one side of some sort of physical thing to the other. ADSL is layer one. Your cable modem is layer one.
Okay.
So problem to be solved with layer one is just one packet from one side of a network to another. And it doesn't matter whether it's an Ethernet network, whether it's ISDN, whether it's ADSL, whether it's fiber optic. A layer one problem, get one packet from one side to the other. And that's all layer one does. Now, that's great within your LAN, but we don't want to stay within our LAN, right? We want to go...
Can we go outside?
Yeah. So the next problem to be solved is getting one packet, and we're still talking one packet, from any device in one network to any device in any other network connected to it in any way, no matter how indirectly.
Okay.
And that's the internet layer. So that's layer two.
These are well named.
They are well named. So link layer, internet layer is next. Now, if you take one network and you connect it to another network, the name for that is an internetwork. And
a who?
An internetwork. Is
internetwork,
a network,
okay.
Of networks. It's called an internetwork. And that's almost always abbreviated to internet.
Oh, okay.
Now, there is an internet as a concept. I can sit here in my house with some cables and some routers, and I can build myself three networks that talk to each other. I have built an internet with a lowercase I. The internet is exactly the same concept, but we as a planet have decided that's the one.
So, that's interesting. I've heard that called intranet.
Yeah, that's... An intranet is an internet. The internet is an internet.
Say that one more time.
Okay, so an intranet is an internet because it has multiple networks connected together. Anything that has multiple networks connected together is an internet with a lowercase I. The internet is just the connection of networks we as a planet have decided is the one we will use to communicate with each other. We had to pick one, right? Otherwise, we couldn't talk to each other.
Right, right.
It's just the one.
Intranet is not a real word in official...
It kind of is. It's more of a... No, it's
convenience?
Buzzword, I'm afraid.
Okay. All right.
So, the internet is like the moon. There are other moons, but only one of them gets a capital M. There are other internets, but only one of them gets a capital I. Okay? So, if you're talking about the internet as in that thing which all of us use to talk to each other, capital I. And it is actually important if you're being pedantic. So, capital I.
Well, actually, exactly. It's a capital I. So it's okay because autocorrect fixes that for me because I never capitalize it and it always changes it. So, I'm always correct.
Excellent. Unless you're trying to talk about an internet that's not the internet, and then you're wrong.
There you go.
Doesn't happen very often in the real world. Anyway, so the real magic of this layer is connecting two networks together. And you bridge networks with something called a router. And a router is just a device, some sort of computing device, that has two network connections, one in network number one and one in network number two. It might have three. It could actually have any amount, but it has to be an amount two or greater, and then it's a router. And okay. it can talk layer one inside each of those three networks, and so it can act as a bridge to lift a layer one packet from one and drop it into the other. So our home routers speak at least two layer one languages. They all speak Ethernet, because all of us have Ethernet on the inside. But then they speak one other language to allow them to talk to the outside of the world. So if you have a cable modem, it speaks cable modem language. Now, I went to look to see which language cable modems speak. There's about 50 to choose from, so I'm going to leave it at cable modem language.
Okay.
Or if you're unfortunate enough, you live further away, maybe your router speaks Ethernet on the inside and ISDN on the outside. Maybe it speaks ADSL. The point is, your router can speak two different layer one languages, and it can send packets from one to the other. So when you're talking to me now over Skype, our little packet is being... Ethernet gets it as far as my router. Then, in my case, a cable modem gets it as far as my ISP. Goodness knows what gets it across the Atlantic. Probably a fiber optic cable. So that's a different layer one yet again. Eventually, it makes its way to your router, probably over a cable modem, back to Ethernet, and finally into your computer. So lots
that's
of different
amazing.
Layer ones. Lots and lots of different layer ones can be used for one little packet. And that's, again, the magic. So the really, really hard job that layer 2, the internet layer, has is figuring out how to connect point A to point B. Because each router has multiple possible paths to send a packet down. Okay, it comes in from the inside. Our home routers actually have a really easy job. Is it for the internet? Then it goes that way. Otherwise, it doesn't. But the router in your ISP probably has 5, 6, 10, 20 possible that ways. And that connects to another router, which might have another 10 or 20 possible that ways. And yet, somehow, despite the fact that all these networks are meshed together by 20 kabillion connections, layer 2 can figure out how to route the packet. The fact that we solved this as computer scientists continues to amaze me. It should be one of the wonders of the digital world. Like, it is such a big problem to solve, and we solved it.
That is amazing. And I mean, I personally think the transatlantic cable is... amazing from a from another point of view.
From
but
an
you're
engineering
right.
point of view, the transatlantic cable is stunning. And actually, they all come up in Ireland because we're first.
Oh, really?
Yeah, seriously, there is lots of really important cables come up here. The first ever one that worked came up in the south of Ireland. Huh. Anyway, that's a bit of trivia. So there's only one protocol that rules the roost at layer 2. And that protocol is the IP protocol, or the Internet protocol. That's actually what IP stands for. And the IP protocol is responsible for getting one packet from one device to any other device. And the way IP knows what device is which is by their IP address.
Right.
So MAC address is a layer 1 concept. IP address is a layer 2 concept.
Ah, okay.
And so if you imagine a little packet going from me to you, it has one MAC address while it's inside your network. It has a different MAC address as it goes to another router, a different MAC address again as it goes to another router, a different MAC address again when it gets onto your network. But the IP addresses involved are the same. Don't change over that whole travel.
Right.
Okay. Now, we should also note, just put a pin in it, and we're not going to talk about it today, but IP is actually a slightly complex beast because it has little sub-protocols. I'm only really going to mention two. There's one of them that allows you to do something called multicast. So in theory, normally it's one packet goes to one, you know, one source, one destination. But with multicast, you can have one source and many destinations, and that's really important for streaming. That's the IP protocol that manages that magic too. And the other bit of magic it manages is it's a little protocol called IGMP, but its most useful feature is ping.
Okay.
Right, and we'll talk about ping later, but that's also something the IP protocol does for us.
Okay.
So the IP protocol gets one packet from one computer to another computer anywhere else on the internet. Pretty magical so far. But it's one packet. And it's the IP layer that's very prone to throwing packets away.
Oh, right. So what makes that not just fail completely?
That's where layer 3 comes in. Layer 3 is the transport layer. And what layer 3 does is, using it as its basis, this lossy way of sending stuff, it tries to assert order. And the problem is even worse than you think, because yes, we can lose packets. But not only can we lose them, they can get reordered, because each packet is independent. And usually your ISP has multiple options. And so it might say, oh, that pipe's congested, you're going left. Oh, that pipe's freed up, you're going right. And those two U's were part of the same giant big file. So when they arrive on the other end, one of them might be there before the other. So you sent 1, 2, 3, 4, and they might arrive 3, 2, 1. And one of them could just be gone. So the order is completely unreliable, and a whole bunch of them might be missing.
Okay, this shouldn't work.
Right, the transport layer sits on top of this chaos that is the IP layer and asserts order. And there's two protocols that do this for us. There's TCP and UDP.
I've never understood these.
Oh, good. We're going to start with the easiest one, which is UDP. So UDP says, yeah, I don't care about stuff going missing. I'm just going to get the order right and leave it at that.
Okay.
So what UDP does is, it takes as its input a stream of data, it chops it into packets, and says to IP, send that over. And the UDP on the other end gets the packets, and anyone that arrives out of order, it just throws away. And anyone that ever arrives, it doesn't care.
How does it know if it's out of order?
Because if it got it out of order. Sequence numbers. So UDP sticks, the input UDP sticks a sequence number on them, and the output UDP reads the sequence numbers and goes, no, you're in the wrong order. Gone. And it gives whatever it's passing the information to, be it Skype or whatever, it gives it the imperfect stream of data and says it's all in the right order. It's probably missing bits, though.
Okay.
But that's fine for streaming.
Right.
And the UDP has two big advantages. It's really efficient in terms of, it's a simple protocol, so there's not much CPU needed, there's not much RAM needed. It's just easy. And the other advantage it has is it's quick. There's no waiting for stragglers. If stuff arrives out of order, it may as well never have arrived. And so UDP can just hand the data to the app really, really quickly. Here you go. Got this. And so we can have a conversation with only a few hundred milliseconds of lag between you and me.
Right. And that's the worst lag I experience is from me all the way to you.
Considering there's an Atlantic Ocean between us.
A pond, as it were.
Yeah, a pretty substantial bit of pondage there. Impressive.
Yeah.
And so, UDP loses packets all over the place. But it doesn't matter, because what you want, so if you're, if what matters to you is low latency and you don't care about accuracy, UDP is your friend. Now, another way UDP is your friend is if you're doing something over and over and over and over and over again, and you just don't have the resources to do something that takes a lot of RAM, a lot of CPU. And that's why DNS is done over UDP, because it, the DNS root servers handle like a kabillion requests at once. And for them to do a difficult sort of a full TCP setup would mean we'd need to like replace them with servers 100 times as powerful or more. And so DNS is done over UDP because UDP is simplistic.
Okay.
So let's move on now to TCP, which is really the workhorse of the internet. TCP manages to iron over the fact that IP jumbles up our packets and throws some of them away. And the way TCP does this is through the very sensible use of buffers. So the sending TCP implementation keeps a copy of everything it sent. It just keeps a buffer of everything it sent already and holds on to it for a while. The receiving guy gets the packets, they have sequence numbers, and it also has a buffer, and it starts to assemble the pieces. And so if part 4 arrives first, we put it in position 4. Oh, next one we get a 6, we'll put it in 6. Oh, 5 is still missing, no worries.
Wait. UDP already threw away anything that was out of order. How did it end up out of order still?
Okay, so a packet travels either over UDP or over TCP. TCP does not stack on UDP. So UDP sits over
it's
IP.
It's one or the other.
Yeah. So UDP sits over IP, or TCP sits over IP.
What's making the decision which way my packet goes?
Whoever further up the chain said, I'd like to talk to that computer over there.
So when I connect into Skype, Skype is saying use UDP?
Yes. Somewhere in Skype, there's a C code that says, I want to talk UDP to that guy.
But if I'm putting an Excel spreadsheet into Dropbox, it's probably going over TCP?
Oh, most certainly, because Dropbox...
You don't want to have just little mistakes.
Correct. So Dropbox uses HTTP. HTTP uses TCP. TCP uses IP. Down we go.
Okay, so HTTP is always TCP.
Yes. Most things are always TCP, because most things we actually care that the stuff that comes out is exactly the same as the stuff that went in.
Okay.
So TCP is straight over IP. So the sending TCP side is keeping this little buffer of everything it sent, and the receiving side is reconstructing that buffer as the packets come in. And if they come out of order, it doesn't matter, because it just fills them in whatever order they come in. But it has a timeout, and if it hasn't seen a packet for X amount of time, it assumes the worst. The packet might arrive later, but it'll just be ignored. It assumes that it was destroyed, and it sends a notice to the sender saying, give me number 4 again, please. And because the sender kept the buffer, it has number 4, and it whooshes it back through the internet and hopes for the best. And the two of them chatter over and back. Yeah, I've got everything as far as 8. Great, I can throw everything as far as 8 out of my buffer. Ooh, you're missing 13. Here's 13 again. Great, I'm now up to 20. Great, everything less than 20 out of my buffer. And the two of them just negotiate over and back, describing their buffers to each other and resending whatever has to be resent. Now,
that's pretty cool.
The actual intricacies of that chatting over and back, as I call it, are an entire undergraduate course. But the point is, by keeping the two buffers and by sending negotiation packets over and back, they can do this magic. And it works. Right, so that's layer 3 done. So our little, you know, layer 1 was get one poor innocent little packet from one computer to another one that's connected to the same network. Layer 2, get that little packet from one computer anywhere on the internet to another computer anywhere on the internet. And then layer 3 was get a coherent flow of data from one computer to another computer.
I love that I understand UDP and TCP. I remember in the old days when my son wanted me to open ports for his games, mm-hmm. and I had to know whether it's UDP or TCP. I'm like, I don't know. I'll put it in both. I don't know what it means.
Well, there you go. So there are two protocols, and an app will use one or the other. And the other thing, actually, you've mentioned port numbers there. So Ethernet, so layer 1 is MAC addresses, layer 2 is IP addresses, and layer 3 is IP address plus port. So if you want to start a TCP connection, you need to have a source IP address, a source port, a destination IP address, and a destination port. They are the ingredients for talking TCP. Or UDP.
Okay, I believe you.
So the final layer then sits on top of all of this. And really, those bottom three layers together, you can look at those as infrastructure. They are the infrastructure upon which we have built the actual things we want to do. And so the last layer is called the application layer, and that's also very well named because that's where all of our apps sit.
Okay.
Now, apps is kind of a broad word. So email sits in layer 4, but it's not a piece of, it's not one thing in layer 4. Email is the sum total of the SMTP protocol, which sits on top of TCP, which sits on top of, you get the idea, and IMAP, which sits on top of TCP all the way down, and POP, which sits on top of TCP and all the way down.
Okay.
The web, when we're browsing the internet, that's HTTP on top of TCP on top of IP all the way down, or HTTP on top of TLS on top of TCP, if we want HTTPS.
Okay.
And then all the way down. And so the stuff we want to get done sits in the application layer. FTP is in the application layer. DNS is in the application layer.
So by application, you don't mean mail.app.
No.
You mean SMTP and IMAP and POP and HTTPS. Those are all things that live in the application layer?
Yes. So the protocols that make our apps go live in the application layer. So they are applications of TCP or UDP, if you want to think of it that way. And that is our full stack. So each layer is solving a different problem, building on, and every layer knows that what's below it has taken care of all of those problems. So it's free to solve a bigger problem. So IP doesn't worry about voltages or currents or frequencies. It's free not to care because it knows that layer 1 has its back. Layer 3 doesn't worry about the practicalities of getting a packet over and back. It just assumes that the IP layer knows how to do that. And then HTTP doesn't have to care about any of that. It just knows that I want a TCP connection from here to here. I shove data in one end, it pops out the other. I'm happy.
I didn't know any of this. Not one little bit of this before you started explaining it.
Oh, good. So I think I had said that this was going to be a long one, and we've just had a little look at this thing called the clock. And so my show notes continue, and we'll pick up from here next time. But how we're going to pick up from here is by doing all that again through a worked example. And we're basically going to, what we're actually going to do is what happens when I type something into my URL bar in Safari or whatever you like and hit enter.
So we could think of this segment was the lecture and we get to have the lab next time?
All right. Well, slightly labish. Actually, yes, there are two terminal commands in the next bit. So, yes, we'll call it a lab.
Oh, just two terminal commands. Okay.
It's a sneak peek, right? Because there are two terminal commands that we're going to be revisiting because they're really cool terminal commands. That's basically where we're going with it. To try reinforce what we've said today, we're going to do it again in a practical way. And then we're going to start at layer 1 and work our way up, looking at the actual terminal commands. Because there are terminal commands to interact with MAC addresses. There are terminal commands to interact with IP addresses. There's terminal commands to look at what's going on at a TCP IP level. And there's terminal commands to interact with DNS and HTTP. And so we're basically going to go through it 3 times. So we've done it now once, purely theoretical. Then we're going to do our worked example, what happens when I get a web page. And then we're going to do it again, but looking in detail at every step and all the cool terminal commands that hide within those steps.
Cool.
But you can see why I said this might take a while.
Yeah, definitely. This is interesting stuff, though. I like understanding the structure behind it and then maybe getting into some more practical examples of why I would care.
You see, and if you don't understand the big picture, the little picture isn't sensible.
Yeah. I hope you do give us a quick overview of what the 4 layers are before we start next time, right? Because it's super fresh in my brain, but I know in 2 weeks I'm going to go, what? Mm-hmm. I remember UDP came up. Yeah. All right. Well, thanks so much, Bart. This is cool. Can't wait to hear the next one.
Well, you're going to have to. And until then, happy computing.
Bart is such a tease. I can't believe he's making me wait, but all right, just fine. Well, anyway, that's going to wind us up for this week. Many thanks to our sponsor for helping to pay the bills, BlueMangler Learning at BlueMangerLearning.com, makers of Clarify. Don't forget to send in your dumb questions. We haven't had a dumb question in quite a while. We have Victor Cahiao right here in the live chat room right now. Didn't get to hear the dumb question corner music, so bring him on. And do send in comments and suggestions by emailing me at Allison@podfeet.com. You can follow me on Twitter @Podfeet and check out the NoSillaCast Google Plus community too. I love that community. I'm always asking questions in there, getting great answers. It's really, really good. It's easy to find, podfeet.com/Google Plus. whenever somebody sends me over a question and they label it dumb question, like, who did that? Was that Kevin in Connecticut? Yeah, I think it is. Kevin in Connecticut asked me a really hard question, and he labeled it dumb question, I think. And I was like, you know what? Just go over to Google Plus, post it there, and then we'll just let smarter people than me answer it. So again, that's podfeet.com/Google Plus. Another fun thing to do is to join in the fun of the live show. We had a really hot room tonight, had a lot of fun going on while I'm doing the recording. They like to tease me. It's a great time. So all you do to get into there is go to podfeet.com/live on Sunday nights at 5 p.m. Pacific time. Join the friendly and enthusiastic Nosilla Castaways. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.